Hey everybody, I'm Dave, I'm a cocaine addict. And I need a tissue here, so I don't know, use my sleeve. I think she loves me. I don't know. The crazy thing is, you should have met me before I got sober. Because she's talking about a completely different person. Trust me when I tell you. And I'm grateful to be a member of Cocaine Anonymous. And thank you, honey, for those kind words. I paid her to say that. So I'll say a few kind words about her. She paid me. We're good to go. And thank you, honey. I love you. And I want to thank the committee. This is a big task. Being of service at any level, not just in Cocaine Anonymous, but at work, or that's what we do. We learn how to be a service to people. We're supposed to be a maximum service to God and our fellows. And when I came in here, my sponsor taught me this is what we do. We are of service. And I didn't know what that meant, because I got to tell you honestly, I ended up in my room by myself, and I'll try to get into that. I'm going to be a little limited on time, so I'm going to give you kind of the breakdown a little bit. But thank you to the committee for all your hard work. This is a really fantastic. I love Stockholm. This is really great, and I know what it takes to put these on. So you guys did a great job, and I think we should give them a big hand. I met Camila and Matthias. They came over to the States, and they were coming and bringing the message that Sweden was growing and doing very well, and they're having a convention, and just two of my favorite people. And so they come out and stay with us. We go do some things, and so Maria and I said, "Yeah, we got to go to Sweden," and because after 2014, Maria and I got burned out. We've been of service since 1987, and we just got burned out. And I was talking with my sponsor. My sponsor's an AA guy. His name's Bill Cleveland, and he goes all over the place. And I got to talk to him. And he goes, you need to go back to the meetings and just be an Indian among Indians, a friend among friends, and I'm like, yeah, no problem, I'm doing that. So I just went back to what we started with. And Marie and I used to go to Radford and all these big meetings that were AA meetings, but we went to CA, but AA is where we got the message. They did not have a Cocaine Anonymous book back then. They had an Alcoholics Anonymous book, and my sponsor, when he gave me that book, anyway, we used to wash coffee cups all the time, pick up cigarette butts, and that's what we did. That's what we started out doing. And I hated it, but I did it, you know? And I need a Kleenex. Can I get a Kleenex? And thank you. My nose is running. I must have done some coke before I got here. Remember you remember when we used to try to go to work and we'd say, hey, I got a cold. It's a summer cold. It's a winter cold. It's a springtime cold. I don't know. I'm just not showing up to work today. Forget about it. And today it's just because I'm crying, so forget about it. Anyway, hey, take a deep breath and feel this feeling right now. Just check this out. I don't know how many people are in this room right now, but this is the Fellowship of Cocaine Anonymous. Feel that. I don't know about you, but when I was doing coke, I didn't want all you all in the room. I wanted to be in the bathroom with my coke and lock the door if I was at a party. If you're new here and you're feeling all alone with all these people around you, I understand that. I didn't come in here with a bunch of friends and a bunch of money and cars. I had nothing, and I didn't know anybody. And the first meeting that I actually went to or tried to go to, the guy who lived behind me was drinking very heavily, and so were we. And he said, "Look, there's this. I'm an alcoholic. I got to go. I'm going to this meeting. It's over on Sherman Way." And I'm like, "Oh, I'm not an alcoholic, but I got a problem." And so I went to try to find this meeting, and I couldn't find it. And so I just kept doing what I do. And here's what I do. I started, as a very young kid, stealing from people in stores. I would take cigarettes from my mom's purse. She smoked Alpines, you know, that was menthol cigarettes back in the day, and Kents. And I was about 8 at the time. And me and my brothers, that's what we did. We would steal. We're kids. We go, we steal from the stores, we take cigarettes, and pretty soon we're, you know, we're getting a little money, and we go to the stores, and we say, well, we want some cigarettes from my mom, and we would smoke. And so I started smoking at a very young age. And I didn't start doing drugs till I was about, gosh, I don't know, I was old. I was like 14, 15, I think. And we started kind of messing around with marijuana. I love marijuana. I love pot. I mean, I love all kinds of pot. And we got really good with pot. We bought an isomerizer, and we'd clear out the garage, set the isomerizer in the middle of the garage, and we would make our own hash oil. And I loved hash. I love all kinds of pot. We used to have Humboldt Sticky Bud and Purple Bud and Thai Sticks, and we'd make Blonde Leb and Red Leb, and we were really good at it. And we would find, I would just find plants. My grandfather taught me a trade. I'm an electrician by trade, and my grandfather taught me the trade. And I remember one day I was about 15, maybe 14, and he's got me working at this house with him, and they've got this crawl space, and I look over in the neighbor's yard, and I see these huge plants with these buds on, and I'm like, I wasn't thinking about working at that point. I went directly to, how do I get those plants? And so I got these boxes all set up under the house, and I scoped out the house, and I made sure I knew where my grandfather was, and I looked around, and I hopped this wall, and I went to pull these plants out. They wouldn't come up. And I'm pulling and pulling. I finally got them up, hopped them over the wall, put them in the boxes underneath the house, brushed myself off, and went to work. And that's what I used to do. And then I got into coke. And when I got into doing coke, that changed my life. And that was, like I said, that was about 15, 16-ish. The neighborhood kids, we would go to the train station. We lived by Busch Gardens. We would steal the containers off the thing. We'd put them all around the neighborhood so we could drink beer. And we'd buy grams of Coke. And at first it was like a party, you know. You get the mirror, you make these lines, and you draw these pictures, and it's a lot of fun, and everything's great, and then pretty soon your hair's in it, and I used to have really long, super long hair, and then I had to start working, and I was doing a job one time. I was drilling safety parts for airplanes, and they had these troughs of oil, and I remember I had really long hair, and I took some pills that I used to. I love doing coke, but I also drink alcohol, and I love all kinds of mind-altering substances. And a lot of stuff I took, I didn't even know what they were. And so one day I got a hold of a couple of these red pills, and I popped them, and I didn't feel them for a while. But I got to work, and I'm sitting there, and I'm drilling these holes, and the next thing I know, my hair is in oil, you know, and I'm just like nodding. And so I never used to think I had blackouts either, but I got up, and I walked to the supervisor. I just looked at him, and I left. I have no idea how I got home. But I do remember coming to, and my brothers and a couple of friends were sitting there staring at me, and I'm like, my shirt's off, I'm soaking wet, I have no idea where I am at first, but then I realize, and I'm like, how did I get here? And what are you looking at? Let's party, you know? So we just went going. And the older I got, the more I got into it, the worse it got. And I used to do things like, I had a GTO with a 455 in it. And it's a really fast muscle car. And when I would do coke or downers, this particular time, fortunately, thank God I was on downers. But I got in my car. I was going to get something. And I'm driving down the street. And all of a sudden, next thing I know, the light turns red, and I bump into this guy. And he gets out of his car. What are you doing? What are you doing? I said, I'm sorry, man. I'm really sorry. He gets back in his car. We drive down. The next light turns red. I bump into him again. He gets out of his car. What are you doing? What are you thinking? Gets back in his car and takes off. And I'm like, wow, what's happening right now? Get to the next red light. I do it again. I mean, this guy is pissed. And I have no idea what happened. He left. Somehow I blacked out. I ended up back in my house somehow. My car's gone. My dope is gone. The girlfriend that I had at the time was gone. And I'm just like, what is happening? And I never thought I had blackouts until I did my 4-step and started remembering all that stuff. I was pretty angry. When I was 18, my mom actually moved out of the house. She had had enough. my little brother committed suicide the year before. And so if you have any ideas of suicide, or you know people who have committed suicide, it's a pretty bad disease. And he shot himself, and I found him, and that catapulted my drug abuse. I mean, I just full blown from that point on. And at 18, my mom moved out of the house. My buddy moved in. It became the party house, and that's all we did. Was we partied, we drank, we used. I would get angry, and because I was so mad at everything, I would take the furniture out of the house and throw it up against the wall and break it all. So we didn't have much in the house as far as furniture. We just had a wide open house. So I thought, oh, this is perfect. I also play music. I love keyboards and pianos and guitars and all kinds of things. So I there's no furniture, so I just set up a studio. And we'd have people come over all the time, and we would just party and play, and just it was crazy. And what happened for me was I just got to a place where I just couldn't live like that anymore, you know? I had gotten to a place where I had burned through all my friends. My mom moved out. She didn't want anything to do with me. And I had nowhere to go. And I was living over in Van Nuys, and there's a little Italian girl who used to live next door to me, and I would see her once in a while just because it was convenient, really, for no other reason, but it was convenient. And I went over to her house one night, and I was supposed to be there a few nights earlier, but I couldn't make it because, you know, in the book where it talks about, you know, there was a big event, and a day or two before that event, we take that first drink or that first hit, and pretty soon the event doesn't matter anymore. That's who I am. And so I showed up at her door, and I knocked on her door, and she just looked at me with that look of disgust that we get from people when we're using and drinking, that just that disgusted look, like, you know, you are so pathetic. And I already know that, but, you know. So she gives me a phone number, and this phone number was for a hospital's institution. At the time, I didn't know what that was, and I called the number because I knew I had a serious problem. I just didn't know what to do. And I called the place up, and I didn't have any insurance because when you use and drink like I do, you don't have insurance. It's hard enough to pay the rent, and my rent was only $200, and I was splitting that with somebody. So it was hard enough for me to pay my rent. And you don't eat, you know, when you eat, it's something like a, you know, 30-cent cup of noodles or something. And, you know, maybe there's, you know, some peanut butter in the cupboard or something. And if that doesn't work, who cares? You know, all I care about is I need something to drink. I need some Coke or some pot. And so she gives me this phone number, and I called the place up and fully expecting that they were going to say, look, man, we don't want anything to do with you because you don't have insurance. But what the guy said to me was, I understand. There's a meeting right down the street from your house. Why don't you go to it? And I thought, I don't know what that is, but okay. And so I went down to this meeting, and it was an H&I meeting. I had no idea what that was, but there was four guys sitting up on the panel. I'm sure a lot of you know what those are. And I listened to these people, and I was like, ugh, I don't know, man. This is really crazy. My head's just all messed up. But I heard a few things there that night, like, you know, sponsorship, and there is a solution. They never said what the solution was, so I thought it was a big secret, like a secret meeting, like, you know, like you have to join the club, and then they'll slowly but sure you give the solution. And I would love to say that I stayed sober that night, but I did not. And I went right back to my using and drinking. And, you know, I my buddy and I went to Bullhead City, and I see my friend Woody moved to Bullhead City. I can't see him. I had four eye surgeries over the last year and a half, so it's hard for me to see a lot of things. But my friend Woody moved to Bullhead City. We used to party in Bullhead City all the time. And we had rented a car because my Firebird, one more time, was in the shop. I couldn't keep it running. I just put it in the shop and left it there. And so we scraped up money, got a car, went to Bullhead City. And 5 o'clock in the morning, we were driving away from the casino. And my buddy's driving the car. And we're laughing and just looking at each other. We're drunk. And the next thing I know, I'm looking over and I'm thinking we're going off this cliff. And I remember everything just slowed down. And, I mean, to the point where it was like, I just felt like, whoa. Like you see those movies where everything's in slow motion. And the next thing I know, we just fast forward to a mountain and we rolled the car like 3 times. It ended up upside down. I had a Michelob beer between my legs the entire time. I didn't spill one drop. Because there's no way I'm losing my beer. We didn't, nothing major happened. My buddy broke his thumb because he was trying to hang onto the steering wheel. But I remember I couldn't get out my door. And so I kind of climbed over to the back door and got out. And my buddy starts climbing out. I remember throwing that beer bottle. And the first thought of my thought was, oh, my God. Second thought was get the ice chest and get a beer. problem with that was people were starting to stop. And I'm like, oh my God, people are so inconvenient, you know? So what if the car's upside down? I need a beer. And so these are like the ominous warnings that we fail to heed. And my buddy and I actually, we went to the hospital. Ambulance came, took us to the hospital, check us out. And there was a sheriff who showed up at the hospital. And he's one of these big sheriff dudes that they have out there. You probably see him on TV with the brimmed hat and the, you know, the big gut and the look. And he says, you know, you boys are in a heap of trouble. We found some marijuana in that car. And I'm pretty quick. Your guys are pretty quick. I looked at my buddy. I said, is that, you don't smoke pot, do you? And he's like, no, I don't smoke pot. I looked at that sheriff with my best bullshit, and I said, you know, we don't smoke that stuff. That's a rental car. It must have been there when we got it. And he gave me that look that I've seen 1,000 times. You know, that disgusted look, you pathetic human being. And it broke my heart, but I didn't care. I just didn't care. We left the hospital. We went over to the tow yard to look at that car, and I was standing there looking at it through the fence. I just had this despair, this feeling of, I can't, first of all, we're lucky to be alive. Second of all, I can't keep going on like this. I can't keep going on like this. We lucked out in that situation. And so shortly after that, I get to this meeting, and then a month later, I go back to this meeting. It was a Friday night, and I believe it was the Vista Recovery House. I'm not really sure, but it's an H&I panel meeting. There was one guy who was there before. It turns out he's the panel leader. I didn't know that at the time. I just recognized him. And there was three women on the panel. And I'm like, oh, now we're getting somewhere. And so, you know, I am not a vision for you. Trust me when I tell you. I am not a vision for you when I go in there. But I heard the same things. I heard there's a solution to your problem. If you use cocaine like we use cocaine, and so after they were done sharing, this guy, now at this point, before the guy had jewelry, he was all decked out. I called him, you know, everybody called him Mr. Lee for a long time because he was totally decked out in jewels. But this time he had this neck brace on, this fake leather jacket, and he walks up to me with his best grin and says, hey, how you doing? And I looked at him, I says, well, how the fuck does it look like I'm doing? And he looked at me with a big smile and says, well, you look like shit, but it's going to get better. And I thought, what? And for some reason, I didn't punch the guy. For some reason, I looked at him and I just thought, well, what do I do? He goes, I'm glad you asked. We're going to go over to this Dickens meeting tonight. It's an AA meeting. We're going to be over there. It's tonight at 7:30. After this, you got to go over there. I'm like, yeah, okay. Alcoholics Anonymous. I had my Hawaiian Booze Crew shirt on and my Chevy's Regal hat, so I was dressed for the Alcoholic Anonymous meeting. But here's what happened. Everybody left. I walked out to the parking lot, and I was standing there by myself. I come from my room by myself. That's where I ended up. Nobody knocked on my door to see if I was alive anymore. I was done. And I'm standing in this parking lot, and I'm looking around, and I thought, I can't go to that meeting. I don't know what that's about. And these guys, these people are just, they're fake. And I thought about going to the store and getting beer and starting all over again. But for some reason, I decided I'm going to go to this meeting. So I got over to this meeting, and at Dickens Street meeting, you have to walk down these stairs, and you walk into this brightly lit room with 1,000 people all smiling and laughing and drinking coffee, and I'm like, oh my God. I got down to the end of this stairway. I'm like, no, I can't do this. That guy saw me. He grabbed me. He pulled me into that room, started introducing me to all those people in there, and I felt like not a part of, I felt really overwhelmed. But it's like they didn't let me go. They brought me in. And that's what I love about the Fellowship of Cocaine Anonymous. We don't let you go. We bring you in. And that's why when Maria says, I'm standing out there talking to the newcomer, I don't want him to go away standing there in that dark, looking around thinking I'm going to go to the liquor store or I'm going to go to the dealer's house. I want him to know that there's a place to be, that we care. And it's inconvenient sometimes. You know, if you're new here, who cares? Inconvenience these people. If they won't be inconvenienced, you find me and I will be inconvenienced. I heard a lot of really great things that night. You got to get a big book. You got to get a sponsor. I remember they didn't have the Cocaine Anonymous book back then. You got to get a sponsor. I'm like, what the hell is a sponsor? I have no idea. And so after the meeting, Lee came up. We were talking. He says, hey, man, I'm going to go to this meeting tomorrow morning. He said, over at the Radford meeting. You need to come over there. I'm like, okay, I'll come over there. And I woke up the next morning. I didn't come too. I woke up the next morning, and I felt different. I had not felt like that. I can't even tell you. I can't tell you when I felt like that. But I think what that was my first glimpse at hope, that there's something that will actually work for a guy like me. Now, I don't want to get into all the stuff that I used to do, because you guys already know that. You know what we do. You know the lengths and the depravity and the despair that we get into. That's where I come from. What I care about is the hope. Is this going to work for me? So I met him at Radford the next morning. Now, these are big hitter meetings. I didn't know that at the time, but these were big hitter meetings with a lot of time in AA. Alabama Carruthers, Don Potter, Mort, all these people had a bunch of time, and I'm getting sucked into the middle of it. I wasn't taught to go to the fellowship and go dancing and things, although we did a lot of that. I was taught, you work the steps and you're going to be of service. Okay. I asked him to be my sponsor that morning because I didn't know what it was. But he says, I couldn't wait for you to ask me. And I'm like, oh, Jesus. Did I just make a mistake? He was very enthusiastic, this guy. But let me tell you what this guy did for me. He got me into the steps. That's the first thing he did for me. So if you're new around here, if you've been around here and you're not in the steps, please, please, please do yourself a favor and get into the steps. And if you can't carry a message, please, please, please get these people to the message. This is a life-threatening disease that we're dealing with. It will kill you. And trust me, I know I've seen a lot of people die. My brother died from it before he ever had a chance to see any kind of 12 steps. A lot of people have died since Marie and I have been sober. So I know how devastating this disease is. And if you don't want to die from this disease, I suggest you get a sponsor, you get a book, and you start working these steps. And if you can be of service to people, even better. Whatever level that is, I don't care if you're picking up cigarette butts. I don't care if you're washing coffee cups. I don't care if you're just calling people, or I don't care. Do something that will get you out of yourself. He started taking me to these roving book studies. They were every Saturday night. There was just a little group of people. We'd go here, we'd go there, we'd go there. But he said, you're going to Mike Ross's big book study on Thursday night. You're not going to miss it. I'm like, okay. Wednesday, I'll just jump back a little bit. Wednesday, I went on the 26th, I went to this CA meeting. It was the first CA meeting that I went to, and Maria was the coffee person. And by the way, I didn't want to go out with her because I had already just blown through all kinds of relationships. I wanted nothing to do with women when I got here. I didn't want to be broken. I wanted to be fixed. I wanted a solution, and that's what I was looking for. And it wasn't going to be in a woman. And, well, at the time, I mean, you know, a couple years later, that's a whole different story. But so I became the setup person of that meeting, and it was only like 15 people. I was, this is simple. I had service, 15 chairs, not a problem. Pretty soon that moved over to the American Red Cross. It's a love and tolerance meeting. It was over on Vineland. And pretty soon it moved to the American Red Cross. It became the biggest meeting in the valley, and for a very long time. Now I think you can find that meeting. It moved over to the church that I used to go to for a very long time as well, as I was getting sober, and it's over in North Hollywood. Love and Tolerance meeting. That was my original home group. In 1999, when Marie and I got together, I moved down to the South Bay, and I had already worked my steps. My first sponsor took me through the steps. He made me do what they call a teensy peek inside for my first fourth step, because he didn't want to overwhelm me with the entire thing. Bye, Camille. I love you.
Love you.
And so he made me do a teensy peek inside and take a look at who am I? Who am I really? Who are you honestly? And after we kind of did that, we did a fearless and thorough moral inventory. And I took a good hard look at who I am. And it wasn't pretty, I can tell you that. And this is where we lose most people in a fourth step. And, I learned the steps, and I'm really grateful that I learned the steps and I worked the steps. You know, I learned about powerlessness, you know, that craving. You know, powerlessness is this craving beyond my mental control. And I know what that is, because when I use cocaine or I think about cocaine, I can't stop doing cocaine until I just run it to the ground. That's my powerlessness, that craving beyond my mental control. You know, and so I have to admit, the first requirement is that I have to admit that a life run on self-will is hardly a life that's successful. And I could already see that in my life. You know, I couldn't show up for work. I couldn't get out of my room. I was an electrician. I was running a crew at one point. I couldn't get out of my room. I would throw the keys on the back porch and the guys have to come pick up the truck and I'm hiding in my closet. And so, you know, I learned how to live the first step very early on. And then I learned about the second step. You know, I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, you know. And so when I'm a program dummy. I ask a lot of questions. And when I read that and I say, well, what does that mean? Well, if you came to believe, it means it took some time, you know. And I believe that faith is born of experience. I truly believe that faith is born of experience. If you're sitting in here with 30 days or 60 days or 90 days or 10 years or 20 years, think of the experiences that you have. I'm sorry to say it, but that God has brought you through. Now, if you don't like the word God, I understand. Use a higher power. As long as the big book doesn't say you have to believe in God or else you'll get loaded. That's not what it says. All you need is a desire to stay around here. And all you need really is a higher power that, you know, you grow along spiritual lines and it makes sense. We had a girl that we knew who Stevie Winwood was her higher power. Guess what happened to her? So I'm just saying, pick something that if you don't like God, that's okay. Trust me, it's okay. There's a lot of God in the big book. It's just pick your own higher power. That's all you have to do. But step two, I came to believe that this power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, right? I was insane. And if you ask most people what insanity is, the first thing you're going to hear is, well, that's doing the same thing over and over expecting different results. Because that's what we hear and that's what we say. That's what we do. But actually, the word sanity is soundness of mind. And so with me, my mind was so unsound, I was so insane that all I wanted was soundness of mind. And I believe that today I'm restored to soundness of mind. And that's my lofty goal in life. I just want sanity, you know? At some point, you got to make a decision to turn your life and your will over to the care of God as you understand Him, or this higher power. At some point, you got to do that. Or don't. I don't care. It doesn't matter to me. You do what you want. It's your life. Be who you are, but be honest about it. If you don't want to do it, that's okay, you know? But I had to make a decision to turn my life, my will. My life is what I'm doing. This is my life right here, right now. I'm here talking to you guys. My will is the things I think, the things I want. I have to turn this over because a life run on self-will is hardly a success. So I learned that early on. So I turned my life, my will over the care of this God. I understood Him. And I asked my sponsor, what is it, like, what is this God? He goes, well, let's write it out. What would you like your higher power to be without any negatives? Just write it down. What do you want it to be? And then we edit it. Any negative, got to go. If that's what you want to turn your life and your will over to, then do that. I said, okay, we'll try that. All right, and then he made me do this inventory. The second one was the fearless and moral inventory. And there was a few things in there that I wasn't going to tell anybody. You know, because it's embarrassing. The ego, you know, the capacity of ego to bypass experience would be humorous if it wasn't so devastating in its consequences. That means we use and drink, we almost die. 2 days later, we forget about all that, and we go use and we drink, right? It's the same thing with the way the ego. It tells me that I can't tell anybody that, because if I tell somebody that, it'll probably kill me, or they'll think less of me, and they'll leave me. They'll go away, you know? And so I did this four-step, and I found about all my character defects, right? Then I had to go do step five, and this is where I got to tell God and myself. That's easy. That's the easy part. But now you got to go tell somebody else. That's the hard part. And this is where we lose most people. This fourth step and this fifth step is where most people go because they're just too embarrassed. You know, I don't want to tell people that stuff. You know, and I told my sponsor all the stuff except for one thing, and I almost used and drank over that. But I called him back up and I said I left something out. He said, "Come on over," and we talked about it. And I'm still here. You know. We got to go to the sixth step, you know, and I'm going to ask God to relieve me of these character defects. Well, I kind of already know what these are. I'm a liar. I'm a thief. I'm a cheat. I treat people poorly. I belittle people. I loom. I'm just, you know, I'm a big angry guy. And so I got to become willing to have God remove those character defects from me. You ever wonder why there's two things like character defects and then humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings? So this is just my opinion, for whatever it's worth. Take it or leave it. It doesn't matter. I don't care. But what I understand is that shortcomings, character defects are things that I'm doing that I should not be doing, lying, stealing, cheating, all these things. Shortcomings are things that I'm not doing that I should be doing. So if I'm a thief, I'm a taker. So my shortcoming is I'm not a giver, right? If I'm impatient and tolerant, that means I'm not being patient and tolerant. I know it's kind of the same thing, but it's really not. So And Earl Hightower used to say, if you want to be a loving person, just practice loving. And you're not going to, it doesn't mean you're going to get that back. Like all of a sudden everybody's going to love you. No, what that means is you practice loving, you become a loving human being. And I love that. When he used to say that, I used to love, I want to be a loving human being, you know? And so, and then I get to my eighth step, and I remember I had a really hard time with that. And I asked, I'm sorry, I know this gets kind of boring because most people don't like to hear about steps. They want to hear really funny shit, and that's just not who I am. I can be funny too, but I was limited to 40 minutes, so I had to cut this down. So I get to, I'm sorry, that's just how it is. You get what you get with me, and I always say to God, you know, you talk through me, I don't really care. And the bottom line is there's a lot of people in here tonight, and if you like me, fine. If you don't, fine. I don't care. I didn't learn that in the program. You know where I learned that? In my acting class. My acting coach, Scott Arthur Allen, was one of the best men that I've ever known. And he used to always say that, Scott, how come you're always so happy? You've got cancer. You could die. He goes, I just love life. You know? And if you like me, fine. And if you don't like me, fine. I am okay with myself. And I'm like, damn, that's what I want. You know, so be open-minded, man. You're not going to learn everything here. You'll learn a lot of things in a lot of places. I hear some people say, I'm never going to date anybody in the program. I say, well, you're closed-minded. Could you imagine if I would have said that? I would have never met my wife. So don't be closed-minded. Be open-minded. So anyway, the eighth step, I go, man, what do I do here? And one guy just looks at me like, well, you already did it. I go, what do you mean I already did it? Yeah, you did it in your fourth step. I said, well, then how come I don't know it? I asked a lot of questions. He said, I don't know, because you're stupid. I said, oh, that's perfect. Thank you very much. I had a lot of people call me a lot of things. You're unavailable. You're unapproachable. You're stupid. You're angry. You're this. You know, I'm tired of that stuff. In fact, one guy said to me at Studio 12, I used to go to Studio, we both used to go to Studio 12 quite a bit. He said that I was unapproachable, and I'd heard this so many times. I grabbed this guy, put him up against the wall. I said, you're not going anywhere until you tell me what that means. And he looked at me, and he decided to tell me the truth. He says, you're an angry guy with a chip on your shoulder, and nobody wants to talk to you. That's the guy that I am. That's the guy that I am. I didn't punch him. I listened to the message, and I became open-minded. I said, then I want to work on that. And I went to my sponsor. I said, how do I work on that? So anyway, I get to my eighth step, and I'm like, okay. So I asked somebody who actually knows. They say, look, how do you harm people? How do you harm people? Well, you already know if you harm people physically, punch them, hit them, car crash, physically, you hurt them, put them in the hospital, put whatever. Mentally, physically, spiritually, emotionally. Wow. Okay, let's try to grasp this. If I harm somebody physically, okay, how do I make amends for that? I'm not a doctor. If I harm somebody emotionally, mentally, how do I fix that? How do I make amends for that? I'm not a therapist. Maybe I could become a therapist, but I don't know. But if I harm somebody spiritually, what does that mean? So if we're going to write this list down, don't you think we ought to know what it means? There was a girl that I was going out with, and I had to make amends to her. So I wrote out the whole list, and I edited it with my sponsor because there can't be anything negative in it, and there can't be anything about her in it. It's just what I did, what's my part. And I had to go. I knew she was getting her hair cut at this certain place. And I waited. And I called my sponsor. She's not showing up. I'm leaving. He goes, nope, you're going to sit right there. I'm like, okay, fine. She shows up. I walk up. I made amends for all the emotional and mental abuse that I had caused. And I used to slam doors and call her names. And, you know, and I had a list of all the things that she had done to me, too. But it's not about her. It's about me. This is the ninth step. And so I made amends for all the things that I had done to her, and she looks at me and she goes, oh, that's so cute. Do I owe you an amends? And I'm like, oh, awesome. And then I remember my sponsor's voice, and he said, it's about you making amends to her. And I just looked at her, I said, I think we're good. Are you good? She goes, yes, thank you. I'm like, okay. And I left. And I can tell you one thing right now, as long as I've been sober, I don't expect people to make amends. And most people don't make amends. And that's okay. But I remember before I got sober, a guy came walking down the street. He owed me $100. And he walks up to me. This is the first time I heard about amends. He walks up to me. He goes, hey, man, how you doing? I said, I'm great. Let's go grab a beer. He goes, no. He says, I just wanted to come and pay your $100 back. I go, well, okay, well, then we'll go buy some Coke. He said, no, I just wanted to, I'm sorry it took so long. I'm sorry I took your money, and I just wanted to pay you $100 back and say I'm sorry. And then he walked away. I'm like, what just happened? Cool, I got $100. And so how do I make amends to people and get them back to the place where they were before I got to them? How do you do that spiritually? If you took somebody away from their creator, their higher power, and you, how do you make amends for that? Especially if they're dead, what do you do now? You know, because you can pay the money back. I know you don't want to, but you can pay the money back. And you can make amends for all the emotional and mental abuse that you did and all that stuff. But don't you think we should know what that is if we have to do it or we're going to do it to secure our recovery? And then we get to the 10th step. I continue to take personal inventory and promptly admit it when I'm wrong. And trust me, that happens all the time. So, you know, I just every day I'm looking for my character defects, my shortcomings. Where can I be a better husband? Where can I be a better father? Where can I be a better businessman? You know, and where did I make mistakes? How can I make amends for that? And then, so there's a lot of detail to all these steps, more than just reading them. Anybody can read them. Anybody, you can read them right now and then just go on with your life. But if you really want to work the steps, don't you think you should know what they are? When I get to the 11th step, you know, I sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand Him. Don't you think I should know what that is? And I'll tell you how I learned meditation. It wasn't in the books or the 12 steps. I used to read this country western writer called Louis L'Amour, and he wrote really great country western stories. And he wrote a story one time. There was this cowboy, and when they would do their fires at night, they would light these little tiny fires, very little smoke, and they would lay down, and before they went to sleep, they would listen to every little noise around them. So if anybody started sneaking into the camp, it would wake them up. And so I'm laying in my apartment trying to meditate. I'm listening to the trash trucks, the noise, the people yelling downstairs, the cars going, the dogs. I mean, my brain was just crazy. And I thought about that. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. I'm going to give that a try. And I did. Every little noise. And the next thing I know, I was out. I'm like, wow. So don't be closed-minded. You will learn a lot of principles from a lot of places if you remain open-minded. And that's how I learned how to, I was praying anyway, but that's how I learned how to meditate. I'm supposed to get in touch with this, a conscious contact with this higher power, right? So that's what I do. And the 12th step, I'm almost out of time here. The 12th step is my favorite part of this program. Because I remember when I came here and how devastated I was by this cocaine and the drugs and just my life, the way I abused people and myself. I was a mess. And if these people hadn't done for me what they did, those things that we learn here, had they just gotten sober, read the black lines in the book and just gone on with their life and did their little working and things like that, I might be dead today. I wouldn't be in Stockholm, Sweden, or I might be a junkie on the street, you know. But when there's people like that who help people like me, that is what I learned, is that's what we do here. We save lives. We save souls. So we keep our meeting, and our meeting's gone down to about 8 to 15 people now. It used to be a really big meeting, but it's like 8 to 15 people. And we go there every Wednesday, unless we're not in town, for when that newcomer walks into the meeting. And I can walk up, and I usually don't walk up right away. I want to kind of get a vibe and, you know, let all the other people, like, rush, you know, bum rush him. I want to catch him after the meeting when everybody leaves, you know. And when I catch them after the meeting, standing there, not knowing where to go or what to do, and they ask me questions like, so I know we're supposed to quit doing coke, but I really love to drink a glass of wine and I really love to smoke pot. I'm like, ah, absolutely. I hear you. And they look at me with like this hope, like, okay, great. I can. And I'll tell you what my sponsor said when I said that. He goes, ah. And he looked at me and goes, oh, well, you don't have a problem with drinking your pot, right? I said, yeah, absolutely not. He goes, great. Well, then you can quit for 30 days, right? I was like, oh. He says, are you willing to go to any lengths for recovery? I'm like, oh. I have a decision to make. And I said, yes, I can quit for 30 days. And so I say the same thing to them. Are you willing to go to any lengths for recovery? Can you not use or drink for 30 days? Ugh. And they hate it. And I don't care. It's my experience. It's what I do. And then it's up to them. They make the decision. I don't control anybody's life. And the ones I really love is when we have a guy in our meeting, Tom, who I love to death, and his wife dragged him in by the ear. Literally, dragged him in by the ear and sat him down. And I've actually talked to a few people that's happened to. And we welcomed him into our group, and he's got 8 years now, I think. It's like 8 years now. And we've got people in our meetings that came in and stayed. They didn't come in and go out and come in and go out and come in and go out. And that's my experience. You don't have to go out. You don't have to go use and drink. I know you want to go use and drink. I didn't go to recovery house. I went straight to meetings and started doing the work. I got the book. And by the way, since we didn't have the Cocaine Anonymous book, we had the Alcoholics Anonymous book. And my sponsor said, every time you see the word alcohol, I want you to change it for cocaine. And that's what I did. It's the similarities, not the differences. And he was really good at stuff like that. So I urge you, if you will, to reach your hand out to the new people and help them. And if you're new here and you're afraid to reach your hand out for help, I understand. You can ask me for help. I will give you my phone number. I don't know if I'll fly back here. But let me tell you, I'm getting old, and that plane flight over here about kicked my ass. We got here Sunday, and I'm still like recovering. I'm like, my brain's, I don't know about you guys, I like feeling normal. And when there's lack of sleep, my brain starts getting fuzzy, and I'm like, I need more coffee, and then the caffeine starts kicking in. I'm like, I need less coffee. Matthias is making me coffee. It's like, I don't know what that is. It's like, it's like 17 cups of coffee down into one, you know? So no wonder I can't sleep. Oh, Jesus, it's like jittery. So I like being normal. I've had 4 eye surgeries over the last, you know, year and a half, and I never had to use drugs behind it, but it's just, you know, life happens when you're sober, you know, and I'd like to say, oh, poor me. Who was it the other night that was saying the boo-hoos and the whatever, they, you know, calls up with the boo-hoos? I can do that too, but, you know, I'm not a victim. I'm just a guy that had a detached retina, and I was lucky enough to have 4 eye surgeries, and I'm standing here today. I can't see very well. I know there's a bunch of people back there. But, you know, I can't see as well as I used to. And if that's what it is, then that's what it is, man. It's just, we just keep moving forward, you know. And God's got big plans for us. So let's try to help him the best we can. And the best we can do is help other people. As you trudge the road to happy destiny, you will meet a bunch of us. And I hope in doing that, you will somehow do that with humility and kindness. And I'm David. I'm a cocaine addict. Thanks for letting me share.